From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker exploded onto the national stage in 2011, taking on the Wisconsin Public Unions. He survived a recall election. Now he's running for president.
My record shows that I know how to fight and win. Now more than ever, America needs a president who will fight and win for America.
He says he is the true conservative. This hour on Point, Scott Walker and the 2016 presidential field. You can join us on air or online. Is Scott Walker the right GOP candidate for 2016? What do you know about him? What do you think? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at Hillary Clinton's economic speech yesterday. But first, Scott Walker and the Republican field. Joining me first from Milwaukee, Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He writes the Wisconsin Voter blog there. Craig Gilbert, welcome to On Point.
Nice to be with you.
Joining us from Washington, Molly Ball, national political reporter for The Atlantic. Molly, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Jane. Good to be here.
And from Des Moines, Iowa, Steve Dace joins us, host of the nationally syndicated Steve Dace Show, author of Rules for Patriots. Steve, welcome back to On Point as well.
Thank you very much, Jane.
So here he is, Republican Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, yesterday afternoon at a campaign rally in Wisconsin after announcing he would enter the presidential race.
We need new, fresh leadership. Leadership with big, bold ideas from outside of Washington. The kind of leadership that knows how to get things done, like we've done here in Wisconsin.
Let me ask the roundtable first. What are the main points of a Walker presidential platform? Craig Gilbert?
Well, I don't think it was really a platform speech. I mean, he's really, I think at least so far in this campaign, he hasn't been selling himself on the basis of new ideas, but on the basis of his political history in Wisconsin, which, as you heard in the clip, is all about fighting and winning. And that's how he's tried to distinguish himself from the field. I think it was interesting that there were some issues he didn't talk about in the speech, like immigration, and he treaded lightly on social issues. But other than that, it stuck pretty closely to the themes we've been hearing so far.
Molly Ball, he was reelected governor three times in Wisconsin, garnered the highest percentage of Republican votes of any Republican governor in the nation, and clearly won independents as well. All of this in a state that really that hasn't gone Republican for president since 84. What's the draw here among conservatives and moderate Republicans and independents for Scott Walker?
Well, for conservatives in particular, for the Republican base, they want a candidate who speaks their language and a candidate who isn't wishy-washy, a sort of someone like Ronald Reagan, who Scott Walker has very consciously modeled him after, who is not going to compromise. But at the same time, they are very wary of losing another general election. The Republican Party has lost the popular vote in five of the last six national elections. And after Mitt Romney, who really got people's hopes up in 2012, after he failed to go all the way, a lot of Republicans really felt like they didn't know their country anymore. And they really want to win. They're very focused on electability. So Scott Walker is promising that he can be an uncompromising conservative, but he's not just going to go out there and lose because he's got this track record of winning very tough elections and therefore speaking to sort of the American middle and particularly to the sort of blue state or Midwestern middle class. Mm.
Indeed, Steve Dace. Scott Walker says he wants to cure his party of its weakness for moderates. Does he have a broad appeal, a broader appeal?
I think he's one of the candidates that has potentially the broadest appeal of the Republican electorate in the field corporately. And if, to go to what Molly was just discussing, Jane, she is correct in that the debate in the Republican primary is about electability. But it's really about how are we going to define that to begin with. I mean, we just went through a fall election where we have now, after the results of 2014, corporately nationwide in the legislative branch, we have the fewest Democrats in office since before the Great Depression, 86 years. And I will tell you, conservative angst and anger at the Republican Party has never been higher in my career than it is right now. There is just a feeling that we just elected a bunch of people that were just going to give us what we didn't like about Obama, in the first place. They don't fight on anything whatsoever. They don't take any stands at all. And so the debate about electability is, you know, all these guys the media keeps telling us are the only people that can win never win. So what actually wins? And if you look historically at the Republican Party, since we went through the last major electoral shift in America post Roe v. Wade and the introduction of the solidly conservative South and the Reagan Revolution, since 1980, two things happen and Republicans win every time. If the evangelical base of the Republican Party is energized in the primary and the Republican wins middle-class voters in the general election, he always wins. If he doesn't do those two things, it doesn't matter who the Democrats nominate, he always loses. So if you're looking at electability in this field, whether it's Scott Walker or anybody else, you need to apply that historical formula to this electorate and see who can accomplish those things.
Let's hear from him again, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, at his first campaign rally yesterday as a presidential candidate.
If our reforms can work in a blue state like Wisconsin, they can work anywhere in America.
Molly Ball, tell us about Scott Walker politically, personally. Just give us a brief summary of his biography.
Well, he's the son of a preacher, grew up in the Milwaukee suburbs, and he emphasized very much yesterday his sort of blue-collar roots and appeal, an implicit contrast to a candidate like Jeb Bush or even like a Ted Cruz with his Ivy League degrees. I think he very much is selling himself as an everyman. He's also someone who has been in politics his whole life. So despite the sort of formulaic Republican, you know, peons to the private sector. He is not someone who's ever really been in the private sector. He ran for office when he was still in his 20s, didn't graduate from college, went straight into a political career. There's been, you know, some chatter about whether that lack of a college degree will hurt him. I don't see how it could be a positive thing, but I also don't think it's something that voters are particularly hung up on. But so you know, unlike a lot of other candidates, he hasn't sort of gone up the ladder through going to law school or that sort of thing. And he has won elections. He has won tough elections in hostile territory. He has won elections in, you know, Craig's written a lot about the demographics of Wisconsin and the tremendous polarization of that state. And Scott Walker's wins have really been carried by the overwhelmingly white suburbs of black cities. And so when Republicans look at the sort of demographic map of the United States, if they are to have a path, given the demographic advantages that Democrats seem to have in presidential elections, it is going to be by winning that suburban vote. Mm.
Craig Gilbert, speak more to that, the demographics of 2016 and how that might favor Scott Walker.
Well, you know, I think on paper, his electability argument looks pretty good. I mean, after all, he did win these three elections in 4 years in a state that's been voting Democratic for president. But there are a lot of caveats there. I mean, the midterm electorate in Wisconsin and a lot of other places is more conservative and it's less diverse than the presidential electorate. I think even winning his home state would be a real uphill struggle for president for Scott Walker. You know, he has relied on this tremendous turnout and the margins in the suburbs in Wisconsin. But these suburbs are unusually Republican, the suburbs outside Milwaukee. He's also I don't think he would have necessarily won his gubernatorial races if he hadn't been as strong as he was in rural parts of the state, which was a big part of his recipe for victory. But, you know, it sounds, you know, he's I think to Republican primary voters who are just hearing, you know, three victories in 4 years in Wisconsin, and a lot of people kind of overrate how liberal Wisconsin is. That's pretty persuasive. Mm.
Steve Dace, talk about Scott Walker's distinctive campaigning style, his appeal to blue collar conservatives that we mentioned, the leather jacket, the whole bit. Tell us about that. Describe it for us.
Well, he's really improved the way he is presenting himself and messaging, Jane. And in fact, I know that there were some people, you know, there's also a conservative establishment, like there's a GOP establishment, meaning there are Washington, D.C. conservatives who think it's their job to tell those of us out here, and the crazies in the cheap seats, what we can actually say and think. And so Congressman Steve King had an event in January that was sort of Scott Walker's debutante ball, if you will, his coming out party as a presidential candidate. And he did good, but it wasn't off the rails. It didn't, like, energize the room. And And he gave a lot of talks afterwards that did not bring a lot of confidence to people after he had done things with Americans for Prosperity and others where he had kind of sounded really like Mitt Romney but with a better resume. And yet all these people were talking about how he's the clear front runner. And he was right out here in the cheap seats in the grassroots. He was on pace to be the Tim Pawlenty of 2016. And what's really changed in the last couple of months is he has altered his messaging. And I think what he had to decide to do is decide which sub-primary he wanted to run in. There are two GOP presidential primaries happening right now. There is the establishment primary, and then there is the conservative primary. And I think when Walker first got into this, he thought he was going to be able to straddle that fence. Mm. And he found he cannot. And Rubio, I think, is finding out that right now. And so he changed some things around. He went and retained a very prominent D.C. PR firm that's well-known in the conservative movement, Shirley and Bannister. Craig Shirley is the guy who started it, and he's like Reagan's biographer. And you can see since from that time forward, his messaging has been much more in line with the conservative grassroots, beginning on him changing his position on immigration and the way that he's messaging everything else. It's clear he's trying to reach the average middle class conservative in those suburbs, in those states that Molly was describing.
Molly, speak to the poll numbers. I mean, we can talk about the messaging, but Scott Walker consistently places second behind Jeb Bush in national polls, currently leads the Republican slate in Iowa. Does Scott Walker pose the most serious threat to a legacy candidate like Jeb Bush?
At the moment, the top tier seems to consist of Walker, Bush, and Rubio. And it's very early. We always have to caution not to put a lot of stock in these early polls. They're not predictive, but they tell you where people are lining up right now. They tell you where the sort of hearts and minds are starting to gel. And it's such a wide field, such a fractured field, that you can be in the lead with less than 20% of the vote. And that's the case for both Jeb Bush's national lead and Scott Walker's national lead. But at this point, Scott Walker is the overwhelming Iowa frontrunner.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and his entrance into the 2016 presidential race. You can join the conversation. Does Scott Walker have the right resume for the presidency? Is his track record what we need next in the White House? When Fox News Sunday's Chris Wallace interviewed Scott Walker in March, he asked him to address Republican voters that he'd flip-flopped on several key positions, including immigration. Originally, he was for amnesty for illegal immigrants. Here he concedes that he has changed his position, and he embraces that.
No, I'm not talking about amnesty in any means. And I said the reason for that is over time my
view. But you said you supported it.
And my view has changed. I'm flat out saying it. Candidates can say that. Sometimes they don't. I'm saying my
view. So you've changed from 2013?
Absolutely. I look at the problems we've experienced over the last few years. I've talked to governors on the border and others out there. I've talked to people all across America. And the concerns I have is that we need to secure the border. We ultimately need to put in place a legal immigration system that works.
My guest this hour, Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Steve Dace of the national syndicated Steve Dace Show, and Molly Ball, national political reporter for The Atlantic. Let's get Sandra in here in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin. Hi, Sandra. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I have a lot of negatives about Scott, but I'll stick to just two. First of all, his mantra has been divide and conquer. I really don't care for a divisive president. And he has done that in this state, divided and conquered. In his speech announcing his candidacy yesterday, he used the pronoun we. We will run, not I, running for governor. He's all over the place, changing his rhetoric for whomever happens to be offering him money or to whatever audience he wants his message to be heard. It's we, wherever the money and whatever the audience needs to hear.
All right, Sandra, I got it. Thank you. Molly Ball, what about that? She's saying that the governor is all over the place with policies. Heard a little bit of that here with Chris Wallace, the flip-flop on the immigration issue.
Yeah, and Steve can speak to this as well. I think if there's a major qualm that the conservative base has with Scott Walker, it is that he has shifted at least rhetorically and sometimes substantively depending on which election he was trying to win at the time. So when he was running for re-election in Wisconsin in 2014, he sounded some much more moderate notes. He stayed away from social issues and campaigned as someone who was strictly focused on the economy and the budget. He cut an ad where he looked at the camera friend said that even though he's pro-life, certain decisions would always stay between a woman and her doctor. And he, when the courts made a decision on gay marriage in Wisconsin, said that the issue was over and he was done with it. Now that he's trying to win over the social conservative electorate in Iowa, he's talking about a constitutional amendment to allow states to ban gay marriage. He's signing a 20-week abortion ban back in Wisconsin. And so there is a lot of concern among conservatives about whether he's merely pandering on these issues.
Steve Dace, how do you see it?
Well, Molly is exactly right, which is why I disagree with her that he is the overwhelming favorite in Iowa. And as Molly knows, because she's written about this before, I have an uncanny knack for predicting the outcome of elections here in Iowa. You know, Iowa, the last caucus we had, 60% of the turnout was evangelicals. South Carolina's primary, 65% of the turnout in 2012 were evangelicals. I was just in Washington, D.C. with a bunch of evangelical leaders a couple of months ago, and several of the candidates came in to audition in front of this group. Walker was not one of them. And I will just tell you, there is anywhere from skepticism to open hostility among a lot of evangelical leaders where Scott Walker is concerned. There, you know, the story in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago about his wife and his kids being for gay marriage, the story in the National Journal, I think it was yesterday or the day before, where an anonymous advisor said, well, you know, we just tell these conservatives in Iowa with what we want to hear, so we moved to the middle later, sounding very sketchish, if that's the word, from 2012. I've got conservative leaders on speed dial who text me and emailed me those links. And so, you know, my email inbox right now is very divided on Scott Walker. Mm-hmm. On one hand, there is a resume there that we've never had a Republican presidential candidate bring to the fore. He has the most impressive resume of accomplishment we've ever seen from a GOP presidential candidate in the modern era. On the other hand, it's all the things you guys just asked about, the things that Molly just mentioned. Even yesterday, he barely even mentioned, I think, 10 seconds, what's going to be the number one issue on the ground in Iowa, and that is religious freedom. He barely touched on that. So, you know, this is why we have primaries. These kinds of questions get answered. But here's one more thing I'll throw in. If you look at the history of the Iowa caucuses going back to 1976, you see the same pattern every time. And that is the top two finishers in any order are always the candidate that's the strongest with evangelicals and the candidate that's the strongest with the business community. And right now, Scott Walker is not the strongest candidate with either of those groups. He has a lot of organizational work to do on the ground in Iowa, a lot.
Let me bring up Scott Walker's big battles with labor unions back in 2011. Here he is telling Fox News' Sean Hannity that he's not backing down from his proposed union reforms.
It's time for us to balance the budget. One of the best ways we can do it is tackling these public employee wage and benefit issues. And for us, we're asking for something that is bold politically, no doubt about it. Anytime you challenge the status quo, it's going to be bold, as we've seen in this past week. But really, compared to where everybody else outside of government is, it is a very modest, reasonable request.
So these issues with the big unions, Craig Gilbert, really catapulted him onto the national stage, no?
Yeah, we've been talking about some issues that divide Republicans, including social issues. But if there's one issue that unites Republicans, and this has been a real strength of Scott Walker's candidacy so far in his own party, it's the fight against labor, and particularly the fight against public employee unions. And so the defining issue for him in Wisconsin and nationally has been an issue that pro-business Republicans, moderate Republicans, establishment Republicans, Tea Party Republicans, evangelical Republicans pretty much all agree on. And so, you know, as Scott Walker, as this drama unfolds in terms of Scott Walker's ability to straddle some of these dividing lines in the party, I mean, he has, you know, he's telling social conservatives that he hasn't changed his position on these issues. He's been consistent, but he really wants to be seen, I think, and identified primarily for these other issues, including the battle against labor, because it's such a unifying issue within the Republican Party.
Molly, talk a little bit about this labor union fight. Scott Walker proposed a budget, apparently, that stripped public sector unions of their collective bargaining rights, and these protests lasted for months. Describe what happened then.
Well, this was an issue that his critics pointed out was not a big part of his original campaign for governor. So people felt like it was sort of sprung on them. And Walker, indeed, I've had this conversation with him. He's acknowledged that if he had it to do over again, he would try to sell the idea before he sort of threw it out there. But you know, it was a major drama in the state of Wisconsin, like you say, for months at a time. You had the Democratic members of the legislature actually fleeing the state in order to deny a quorum to the Republicans to keep this from getting passed because the Democrats are in the minority and could not stop it if it came to a vote. And then there was a procedural workaround that was found, and then it went into effect anyway. The effect of these policies has been to really neuter the unions in Wisconsin. And the unions, let's not forget, are not just advocates for workers and for a set of policies for workers, but they are the ground troops of the Democratic Party. In virtually every state, it is members of labor unions that provide the manpower for Democratic candidates. So Democrats really see this as a plot to take away their political strength in addition to advancing a set of conservative policies that conservatives like Scott Walker say are better for the economy and better for the government's fiscal health.
Mm. Here's Scott Walker after that big union issue. He said that his experience undermining labor unions in Wisconsin had prepared him to take on the threat of ISIS in the Middle East. Here's that.
I want a commander-in-chief who will do everything in their power to ensure that the threat from radical Islamic terrorists do not wash up on American soil. We need a leader with that kind of confidence. If I can take on 100,000 protesters, I can do the same across the world.
DNC Communications Director Mo Elethi responded, saying in a statement, if Scott Walker thinks that it's appropriate to compare working people speaking up for their rights to brutal terrorists, then even he is less qualified to be president than I thought. Craig Gilbert, speak to that. He later clarified his remarks.
Yeah, I was at that speech, and I think if he had to do it over again, he would certainly say it a little bit differently. But, this has been a big part of his sales pitch to Republican voters has been look at my enemies. And in fact, if you were in the hall last night at his announcement speech, it was really striking how much of the program was kind of devoted to sort of telling the story and painting a picture of the other side, the left, labor unions, liberals and Democrats, as at one point I think they were referred to as unhinged, as kind of persecutors, as attempting to sort of drive Scott Walker from office. And again, part of his appeal in all this is being targeted by the other side, and then of course defeating them. But this Scott Walker's also had a history in this campaign, at least early on, of things that were perceived as gaffes and missteps, and it hasn't. It certainly hasn't been fatal to him, but I think it's planted some seeds of concern among particularly establishment Republicans about his abilities as a candidate and whether he's ready for prime time.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another Wisconsin listener in here. Willem is in Colfax, Wisconsin. Hi, Willem. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
And guests. I just wanted to say I lived in Wisconsin. I'm 64 years old, and I think our state has never been more divided. We're last in the Midwest in job creation. Our economy, it pales by comparison to states like Minnesota. We're losing young people. We're losing our best teachers. Our university professors are sending out their resumes. So a lot of what Scott Walker claims is his resume is not a resume, I think, for success for America. I don't think that we need, if we're a team, if we're a country, then we don't need someone that's divisive to lead us. And I think that some of the things he's done, like this claim of a budget surplus or balancing the budget, we have a budget deficit. We've had to, he's proposed borrowing huge amounts of money just to fix our roads. He's ended programs like recycling. He's cut science positions from the DNR that had nothing to do with the budget. And also the myth of his stature in rural communities. I live in a rural community in western Wisconsin of 1,000 people, and my village, we didn't vote for Scott Walker. And
one of the reasons
that he won is because of the redistricting, which has been widely reported as gerrymandering. So, mm-hmm. I think when more of Scott Walker comes to light, more people will see that he might be a good politician, but he would be a horrible leader.
Willem, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Jill in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Jill. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Yeah, I'm a public school teacher here in La Crosse, and I was very active in the protests a few years ago in Madison when the Act 10 budget came through. When I heard what he said yesterday in his announcement, he said that he was going to fight and win for the people. And all that he's been doing is fighting against me. and teachers and public workers and people who are just trying to do the best for their community and for kids. So I don't really feel like he's looking out for my best interest as the governor of the state that I live in. And I don't feel that he would be looking out for my best interest as an American. I think he's looking out for his own interest. I think he's looking out for the people that are backing him and the people that are filling his pockets.
All right, Jill, thank you for the call. Let me get some more sound in here. Last October, Governor Walker was running for re-election against a pro-choice candidate, Democrat Mary Burke. He put out this ad seeming to tack a little bit to the left on the issue of abortion.
Hi, I'm Scott Walker. I'm pro-life, but there's no doubt in my mind the decision of whether or not to end a pregnancy is an agonizing one. That's why I support legislation to increase safety and to provide more information for a woman considering her options. The bill leaves the final decision to a woman and her doctor. Now, reasonable people can disagree on this issue. Our priority is to protect the health and safety of all Wisconsin citizens.
And here he is, Scott Walker, on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. Walker had declared himself pro-life, but also said that abortion is a woman's choice. And Wallace had a tough time pinning him down.
Ultimately, it is a life.
But ultimately, it's her choice.
Well, legally, that's what it is under the guidelines that was provided from the Supreme Court.
And would you change that law?
Well, that's not a change you can make. The Supreme Court ultimately has made that. I believe in the right to life, and I believe that there are other things that can be done at both the state and the federal level.
Molly Ball, how important are these social issues, abortion, gay marriage, and the like? How important are they? Will they be in the Republican primary?
I think they're very important, especially in Iowa. As Steve has talked about, there's an overwhelmingly evangelical electorate there in Iowa. And if you look back at what happened in 2012, you see how much of a force these voters still are. I can personally attest that they weren't completely sold on Rick Santorum, who was a candidate who a lot of people saw as sort of second or third best, and they would have liked someone like Mike Huckabee in the race, who is now in the race. But Rick Santorum won that Iowa caucus in 2012 because he was the sort of candidate who was the alternative to Mitt Romney, the establishment candidate, who was speaking most strongly to those social issues. And there is a real hunger for that in the Iowa electorate. So those issues are going to play an important role. And like Steve said, the dimension of this debate now in 2016 is really about this conversation about religious freedom. It's really about what candidates are going to propose to protect religious liberty that a lot of conservatives feel is imperiled in the wake of particularly the recent Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage.
Well, let's hear from him on that. After the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage, Scott Walker said the ruling was, quote, a grave mistake. Both his sons and his wife disagreed, supporting same-sex marriage. One of Walker's sons was a witness at his cousin's same-sex wedding. Here is his interview with ABC's David Muir yesterday. You'll hear Muir first, and then Tonette Walker, then Governor Walker.
And so when your husband, the governor, says it was a grave mistake, what do you say?
Well, I was more concerned that I got calls from both the boys of being upset about what Scott had said. And so my advice to them was, don't come to me. Go to him. He said it.
But you haven't changed your stance.
No. But we love him. And for us, you know, love's going to be the focus of everything we do with our family.
Craig Gilbert, your thought on this.
Well, it's really interesting. I was actually watching that interview and was there for it. And it was really interesting to see how they've been willing to kind of put the story out there that there's this division in the family on this issue. And I think they're comfortable. I can only conclude that they're comfortable with people knowing that. And in a way, it's kind of emblematic, I think, of what we've been talking about, which is this tricky balancing act where he's always been very conservative on these issues, but he doesn't lead with them. And I think they're willing, they want people to know that he's not going to personalize it and that there are more important things to him.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about presidential candidate Scott Walker this hour and his entrance into a very crowded GOP field. You can join the conversation. Does Scott Walker have the right message on the economy? What do you make of Hillary Clinton's economic speech yesterday? Does she have it right? We're speaking with Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Steve Dace, host of the nationally syndicated Steve Dace Show and author of Rules for Patriots, How Conservatives Can Win Again, and Molly Ball, national political reporter for The Atlantic. Let's get some more calls in here. Mike in Boston, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering, my opinion on Scott Walker is probably the same as the previous couple callers, so I won't get into that. But the conversation was about electability. So I'm wondering why every candidate comes out and tries to be the most conservative candidate yet, and they're only looking as far as Iowa, when they're going to have to appeal to moderates at some point and try to get the undecided voters. And getting more and more conservative, I don't think, is the way that you're going to possibly be able to do that.
Mike, thank you. Steve Dace, you see that a little bit with Scott Walker on a couple of these interviews. We played a little bit of the sound on abortion, among other things.
Well, I think everybody here would agree in the Republican Party, it probably doesn't get more moderate than John McCain. And if that's really how you win, why isn't he enjoying his second term at the moment? I mean, this is where people, you know, you have to actually look at data and the way elections are decided. It's like the caller you had who said that Scott Walker won because of gerrymandering districts. I don't know how a governor wins a statewide popular vote election on gerrymandered districts, okay? I mean, the reality is in this last election, Mitt Romney won independents nationwide, beat Obama among independents nationwide. He won them in every key battleground state, Colorado, Virginia, Ohio. The only key battleground state he lost independents was in Florida. And it was a 2 or 3 point spread there. He tremendously outperformed John McCain with independents in 2012, and he still lost. So that's really not how you win. I know that is the formula that we are used to, is both sides get 45%, and then it's really who gets the majority of 10% in the middle. But the truth is, and this is something that Obama has revealed, and this is why he won the last election. He was the first non-wartime president ever to win re-election by getting fewer popular and electoral college votes than the last time he ran. No one had ever done that before. The only two that had previously done it were Woodrow Wilson and FDR, who did it during World War I and World War II. So how did Obama do it? You have a very divided electorate. And so he used wedge issues to turn out his base. And when you looked at the opening exit polls of 2012 on election night, and you saw that the black vote was virtually the same as 2008, the Hispanic vote was virtually the same as 2008, and a majority of voters still blamed Bush for the economy, the election was over before they called a single state. So what you're really looking at is who can do what Obama has figured out how to do, which is to shape the current demographics into their favor, because there really aren't that many undecideds. There really aren't that many independents. Mitt Romney won them the last time and still lost. You really have to look at the Electoral College map as a chessboard. Who can win if you're a Republican, 2 out of 3 between Virginia, Ohio, and Florida? There's never been a Republican, Jane, that's ever won the presidency without winning Ohio, and the Republicans have never won the presidency since 1980 without winning Virginia. So that really is the game. It's not winning the Hispanic vote. Most of the Hispanic vote is in states Republicans can't win, like California, or states Republicans can't lose, like Texas. It really comes down to those three states, who can win those states and flip the demographics in those states and thus the Electoral College.
Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Something I'd like to mention. It seems to me that one of the primary reasons Scott Walker is even mentioned for the presidency is because he is a Republican who won a governorship in a super blue state like Wisconsin. And I just don't really understand that argument. I live in Massachusetts, where we elected a governor 4 years in a row, a Republican governor, 4 years in a row from 1990 to 1992. The last one actually ran for president for the presidency and lost 3 years ago. So winning a We have a Republican governor in New Jersey, another blue state. We had Arnold Schwarzenegger in California, another blue state. The idea that becoming a Republican governor in a blue state qualifies one, elevates one all immediately to the top of the pile to run for president, it just seems silly to me, because the last one in the bluest state in the country lost.
Kevin, thank you. Molly Ball, respond.
Well, obviously there are a lot of things that go into winning a presidential election, a lot of Republican voters, there have been some focus groups and some polling on this, Republican voters overwhelmingly prefer a governor as their nominee, at least when you ask the question in those abstract terms, you know, a governor versus a senator or someone with some other experience, because there is the feeling that that person has been an executive, and not for nothing, that's something that Obama didn't have. And that's part of why conservatives perceive Obama as having been unprepared for the presidency, as not having had a budget to manage and a bureaucracy to run and all the things that governors do. So I think there is a preference for governors in that sense, and then there is this electability argument that a governor who's won in a blue state will be better able to take his message to the rest of the country. You know, as Steve said, there are competing theories of electability out there, especially among Republicans. And there is this idea that if you have someone who runs harder to the right, that's the reason the party keeps losing, is because their nominees have been too moderate and too liberal, and therefore the rest of the conservative base stays home, or even that voters in the middle look at a candidate like Mitt Romney and see someone who doesn't know where he stands. And if you had someone who was more resolute and stronger on conservative issues, then they might win. I would point out that while Romney did win independents, he did not win moderates. And there's a difference between those groups, in large part because a lot of self-identified conservatives, similar to Steve, have left the Republican Party and now consider themselves independents.
Some opposition this hour from callers to Scott Walker. Also some support, though, online. Republicans race from Francis. He says Republicans race is wide open, but with very few electable candidates, Scott Walker could stand a chance. Here's Kurt in Houston, Texas. Kurt, what do you think?
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Here's a guy with a pretty solid conservative message, regardless of where, you know, what direction the election takes him, or not that it would be pandering, but, you know, you've got 8 years of progressivism, well, seven coming up, progressive leadership, elite progressive liberal, and clearly this guy is on the other side of that fence. And to juxtapose him against Ms. Clinton, who is running hard left right now, she'll change more to the centrist when the campaign gets a little more in earnest, as they always do. But there's a clear-cut choice between the two individuals and what's been going on for the last 8 years and the vision moving forward if he gets elected for the next 4 years.
Kurt, thank you. Thank you very much. You mentioned Hillary Clinton. Let's do a little bit of a pivot here. Hillary Clinton gave a major economic speech yesterday at the New School in New York City. Here she is, Democratic presidential candidate, offering her vision for the country's economic future. She's articulating here the central idea of her economic policy.
Families who work hard and do their part deserve to get ahead and stay ahead. The defining economic challenge of our time is clear. We must raise incomes for hardworking Americans so they can afford a middle-class life. We must drive strong and steady income growth that lifts up families and lifts up our country.
Molly Ball, we've talked about Scott Walker being pushed to the right. Is Hillary Clinton being pushed to the left on some of these economic issues, being forced to talk more about economic inequality because of support growing for people like Bernie Sanders?
I don't think we are hearing, despite what the last caller said, a really far left progressive line from Hillary, certainly not as far left as Bernie Sanders. She is talking a little bit of the talk of the progressives who are concerned about inequality, but she's not walking the walk in terms of actually proposing the types of policies that they want to see, which are the types of policies that would really take on big business and Wall Street, breaking up the banks, the kind of thing that Bernie Sanders talks about, even restricting growth in the name of redistributing more wealth. That's not a place that Hillary Clinton is willing to go. Instead, you see her talking about these general themes of fairness, but a type of sort of soft redistribution that she says will not restrict growth and will be able to lift everybody up and raise workers' wages.
Steve Dace, how does this message from Hillary Clinton, the economic inequality message, how does it come across to conservatives, to Republicans generally?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's just Republicans and conservatives. I mean, I think if you look at polling of where the American people are at on these issues, while they about a slight majority still like Obama personally, on actual issues, he's way underwater on almost every single issue of consequence. So what the Republicans have got to do is they're going to nominate a candidate who can call her on that message and say, you know, we've heard all this before, and it came from the previous administration that gave us more people on food stamps than the total population of Spain, that gave us stagnated middle-class wages going back now for 15 years, that gave us a worldwide record of 93 million people unemployed and out of work. And I think record debt, $18 trillion, and not counting unfunded liabilities and mandates, and we're now at the point that in order to pay off that debt, we'd have to tax every household in America an extra $500,000, and only 1% of households in America even bring home that kind of money. You need a candidate who can credibly make those points. And that's why Walker running on that blue-collar message, that is the contrasting message to Hillary Clinton. I mean, if there's one constant in this election, it's that the majority of Americans would prefer not to have to vote for a Bush or a Clinton. But if the election is Bush or Clinton for the eighth time in the last nine presidential elections, I can guarantee you Hillary Clinton will win. There is no chance, there's a snowball's chance in a very warm place Jeb Bush would win, no matter what Hillary said or did, because he would take all of Hillary's negatives off of the table. The Republicans need to look at Hillary Clinton the way the Democrats looked at John McCain in 08. They need to nominate somebody that is younger, has more of a contrast, and connects better with the average middle-class American than Hillary Clinton does.
In her speech at the New School in Manhattan yesterday, Hillary Clinton also said that a big part of her economic agenda involves getting more people into the workforce, especially women and immigrants. That, she said, would drive economic growth.
We are in a global competition, as I'm sure you have noticed, and we can't afford to leave talent on the sidelines. But that's exactly what we're doing today. When we leave people out or write them off, we not only shortchange them and their dreams, we shortchange our country and our future.
Molly Ball, other than saying that more people need, more economic opportunity, what specific policies is Clinton proposing?
The speech yesterday was much more of a vision speech. It was much more about her sort of general prescriptions than it was about a set of specific white papers. But I think what we have seen Hillary doing is paying very close attention to where her base is, and she really does have her finger on the pulse of where the Democratic Party has moved, and even the broader country has moved on a lot of these economic issues. So she is seeing a country that is in a significantly more liberal-minded place than it was even 8 years ago when she ran for president before, and certainly a party where the energy is on the left, and that's why we've seen a candidate like Bernie Sanders drawing these huge crowds. In a lot of cases, on certain issues like on immigration, a lot of Hillary's critics from the left have been surprised at how liberal her stances have been, and she really has signaled a willingness to go quite far to the left on some of those policies. It's on economics where liberals are a little bit less sure about her.
One more clip from the speech yesterday in Manhattan, Hillary Clinton drawing a sharp distinction between her economic ideas and those of Republicans.
For 35 years, Republicans have argued that if we give more wealth to those at the top by cutting their taxes and letting big corporations write their own rules, it will trickle down to everyone else. Yet every time they have a chance to try that approach, it explodes the national debt, concentrates wealth even more, and does practically nothing to help hardworking Americans.
Let's get Tyrone in here on this from Suffolk, Virginia. Tyrone, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Hi. Good. Go ahead.
All right. I just feel like that Hillary Clinton's message is contradictory. When, you know, someone's a millionaire trying to tell us that there's the divide between rich and poor is getting bigger, when she's part of that divide. And to me, it feels a bit contradictory. You know, you can move from Arkansas by a house in New York to run for the Senate. How many average Americans just can up and do that? So it's really contradictory that you're going to help me when you're part of that same divide that you're complaining about.
Tyrone, thank you. Thank you. There's so many callers to get in here. We don't have time, but I do want to go around the table and ask each of our guests, Molly Ball, Steve Dace, Craig Gilbert, which candidates are you looking at in the coming months? We've heard from Hillary, Scott Walker this hour, and several others. But who are you looking at? Who interests you? Molly Ball?
Well, there are so many of them, and they are all interesting in their own way. The last Republican candidate who's likely to get in next week is Ohio Governor John Kasich, and he's somebody I've spent quite a bit of time with. He's a very interesting candidate. He may go nowhere. He is perceived as quite moderate compared to the Republican base. On the other hand, he seems to be getting good crowds in New Hampshire. There's some interest in him, and he has a very interesting resume. So I think it'll be very interesting to see if he can get any traction.
Steve Dace, who do you have your eye on?
Well, if you fast forward between now and the middle of March next year, when the nomination will likely be decided, if you look at the primary calendar, if you look at the resources, you look at the environment on the ground with Republicans nationwide, more than likely the nominee is going to be Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, or Ted Cruz. Mm-hmm. One of those three individuals will be the nominee by this time in the middle of March when we get through the Southern Super Tuesday, and the nomination will all be decided by then.
Craig Gilbert, you get the final last word in 10 seconds here.
Well, I'm pretty Walker-centric, but the only other candidate in the Republican field that probably has the same potential to span some of these divides within the Republican Party is Marco Rubio, and so he presents a really interesting dynamic on the Republican side, I think.
Great panel today. Craig Gilbert, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Steve Dace, host of the nationally syndicated Steve Dace Show. Steve, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Molly Ball, always great to have you, national political reporter for The Atlantic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.